YPG's desert rats tested weapons of war so they'd work when soldiers' lives depended on them. Thousands of veterans walk the earth today thanks to their work. After decades of service, all that's left is testament. Desert Rat Testament is a monthly anthology that collects the stories and recollections of retired Yuma Proving Ground employees of decades-long service.
Hello, I'm Mark Schauer. Raised in inner-city Chicago, John Bullington was originally an enlisted military policeman before graduating from Officer Candidate School in 1983. He worked in military intelligence, then joined the Acquisition Corps, where, among other things, he was the assistant product manager during the development of Blue Force tracking. After multiple deployments overseas, he capped his Army career as the commander of Yuma Proving Ground from 2006 to 2009. Do you recall when in your Army career you first heard of Yuma Proving Ground?
Yeah, basically when I was selected for the command. I had nothing to do with testing at Yuma before. I heard our systems had gone there, but I wasn't involved in that. I didn't know anything about Yuma.
You were in command here during the surge in Iraq. You saw a dramatic increase in the workload. What were those early days at Yuma Proving Ground like?
Well, they were really hard. You know, it takes 6 months to even know what's going on, you know, to understand your workforce, what their strengths and weaknesses are, what capabilities and systems you have, what the test standards are. So, you know, you're just overwhelmed when you first get there, but just trying to figure out what I wanted to get done and what I wanted to accomplish during the first 6 months was probably the primary part of it.
American forces in Iraq were being absolutely bedeviled by improvised explosive devices, roadside bombs, and Yuma Proving Ground was at the epicenter of testing to defeat that threat.
That's correct. Essentially, we had the same exact environment that you would find in certain locations in Baghdad. You know, if you actually went there, it actually looked like it. The weather was about the same. And the signals environment that was set up was very similar to that which was in Baghdad. We had the same telephone network set up there, our own network. So we could mimic exactly what was going on. We knew how the traffic was going over there, all the signals that were going across in a certain location. You can actually like scoop them up and play them into a, you know, kind of live. So you knew exactly what that was. So if someone used a key fob to set off an IED, we knew what those signals were. We could detect them. And if we could detect them, we proposed countermeasures and developed them so when you went past a location, you could jam those frequencies when you're driving through. So those devices could not set off an IED. And it just, the technology, they began using more and more types of technology. And it got to the point where there would be an IED go off, and the next day we would have the information and try to set up a procedure to evade that type of IED going off. So it was almost like a 24-hour cycle. If something new came out, we were on it like the next day, developing something and getting it right back out to Iraq.
I know there was at least 1 year where the folks at Nacotec worked every day but Christmas.
That's correct. And myself and, I'm trying to think of the guy's name that was in charge of the jerk site at the time. Him and Julio Dominguez, all three of us went to Baghdad and saw those vehicles that were being used in the environment. So we had some good hands-on experience as well.
And in those same years, we were doing a lot of testing for the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, too.
That was a new vehicle. that was deployed. I think it was out of South Africa that it was, but the way the hull was, you know, it was more resistant to an IED than any type of vehicle we had at the time. So there was a big surge of procuring MRAP vehicles. And I know that there were many tests to see what the MRAPs could withstand.
At all three of the test centers that you were commander of, too.
That's correct. So every test we had, almost, it didn't matter what it was. If it was a Bradley fighting vehicle that had to do certain things at the Yuma Test Center, all of a sudden you would see the same vehicle that up at the Cold Regions Test Center, seeing if it could operate in a very cold weather environment. And then you would see the same vehicle going down into the jungle areas, either in Panama or Suriname or Honduras or Hawaii, and going through the same motions. So it had to be tested, because what works in one area, like, for example, at YPG, what might work there won't work at the Cold Regions Test Center, won't work at the tropics because of the environmental factors, the humidity, the cold. It does different things to the system. So you need to test it in all those environments.
And your time in command was also an exciting time for precision airdrop technology that YPG was doing a lot of testing for.
Yeah, the JPAD system. That those systems would be dropped, and they were had some type of miniature motorized system on it with a GPS, and they would land in the exact location that it was supposed to land, which was pretty unique. I think it took into effect all the windage and everything that was going on, and was able to work against those elements to land on those locations.
And in those years at the end of the Cold War, following the Cold War, the Army was interested in getting involved in an enhanced use lease projects with private industry. And during your command, the largest such project of that kind in the Army was dedicated, the General Motors test track. What was what was that like, getting that set up?
I was briefed on that, like when I first got there. It was going nowhere. The way I got motivated into it was the terrain and environment in Iraq is different than the sand and environment in YPG. It's been around much longer. There's more, it's been used much more, and it's more of a fine powder, which gets into some of our filtration systems. So and even driving, there's different characteristics. So we had nothing. I mean, vehicles had to race down roads at certain times, you know, at certain speeds that we couldn't do that at. We needed to have a safe place to do that. And we came up with an agreement. We knew that General Motors was in Mesa, Arizona, their proving ground, and they wanted to leave there. And we worked out an agreement with the Corps of Engineers for the Army's biggest enhanced use lease program by far, and it still probably is, but by which they would build a proving ground onto Yuma Proving Ground and allow the Army to utilize their world-class facilities. I mean, their tracks and everything. In addition, they provided the Army with $10 million to provide additional capability that provided some other type of desert vehicle testing along the way, in which they could also use that, those tracks. So it was a tremendous adventure. It took from the beginning of my command there, and it literally got christened the day before I changed command. That was a monumental feat. It was hard to do. It was a lot of negotiation. So, but I knew that if we had soldiers deployed and they had to operate in that environment, they needed to have the capability to operate that way at Yuma Proving Ground. So that was what drove me to it, because I wanted to ensure that soldiers had everything they needed to be successful.
And see, during your entire command, with such an intense workload, Yuma Proving Ground was still winning test quality awards from its superior command. All the tests were done safely and on time. It was a pretty magnificent performance by the YPG personnel.
Safety was one of my very top priorities when I got there. So we went, overboard and had a process by which whenever there was an accident, it wasn't picking on anyone, but instead of, they actually had to come once a month when there was an accident, and the person who was in the accident and their supervisor had to talk about what happened on the accident and what could have prevented that from occurring in the future. So that put some pressure on the supervisor, because the supervisor was the one that had to brief. So that work got out. Believe me, that got out everywhere, because every month we were doing that and people started paying attention. And we had the 360-degree awareness all the time. So we went down, and I was very proud that we had reduced the rate by the time I left by 50% of accidents.
What was your impression of the broader Yuma community while you were here?
They were very supportive of the command. People wanted to work at Yuma. You know, we worked directly with Mayor Nelson at the time, the county. There were some state representatives that we worked with all the time. It was very supportive. And one of the things with the community that we worked with that I was proud of was with all the local colleges. And one of the things we tried to initiate was more of the, science and tech, the STEM program, really focusing on that, because that's the type of capability that we needed at YPG. So we worked with the colleges and tried to get some internships for those folks that were willing to go into those programs, so that we would get the type of local talent at YPG, because when you get folks from a different part of the country, they may move out to YPG and find that they don't like the area, and then a year later move. So we preferred to get our folks locally if they could meet the qualifications. And the community colleges and the regular colleges were very helpful in helping us implement that.
Was it hard to retire from the Army after being commander here?
Well, to be honest with you, I had 30 years in it by that time that happened, and I was pretty much burned out. So I was looking forward to retirement after that. I mean, I loved, the command. It was great. It was probably one of the biggest events of my life. But I also got some good follow-on retirement work as an assistant director at the Arizona Game and Fish Department in Phoenix. And I stayed there for 9 years and retired from there as well. So I was wound up when I was in the Army. I was always focused on making sure that we 100% did everything we possibly could to help soldiers that were on the field. That anything else did not matter to me as much as that. So I did love that, and it took me a while to wind down from that type of mentality, being in the war zones, and being in a war-type environment, because my last 10 years was essentially in a wartime environment.
And in Arizona Game and Fish, in your capacity there, you saw from the other side YPG's outstanding stewardship of the ecology, too.
Yes, well, actually, we had a very, very close relationship. And the guy that was in charge of the Yuma Region 4 Game and Fish ended up being the director. My relationship with him was very good. He had a specific, he cared about the Yuma Proving Ground quite a bit. So, they worked hand in hand, and we worked very closely with the folks at YPG. It was an outstanding relationship.
Do you keep up with Yuma Proving Ground these days?
I read your newsletter. That's the extent. I try to keep myself busy in retirement as much as I can doing stuff. But I miss the Army. There's nothing like it. It is who I am to the core. I'll believe that. I mean, I did it from the time I was 19 till I was 52. So most of my adult life was in the Army. And I love what it stands for. And I believe it's the most noble profession that you can have. You don't get anything financially out of it, but it's personally, you can't find anything more rewarding.
Colonel Bullington, it's really good talking with you today.
Well, thank you.
For as long as the United States has a military, Yuma Proving Ground will be vital to the national defense. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on The Testament.